If you go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, yeah. Left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
My truth is the truth that you will never understand.
Private ownership is one single individual giving green light. Doesn't that tell you that your system is more akin to authoritarian dictatorship?
No, we had a king. I don't want an autonomous collective.
What the heck is a D? How come you can buy our house when it's our house and we live there?
Just when these American citizens needed their rights the most, their government took them away. The rights aren't rights if someone could take them away.
They have every man in a straitjacket. To leave a country is like breaking out of jail. And to enter a country is like going through the eye of a needle.
I don't know if you've noticed, but our two-party system is a bowl of soup looking in the mirror at itself.
Academy essentially opens up policing to the citizens. It's a pretty anarchic idea for an 80s movie.
We not only go on strike, but we need to fire the bosses. This whole you getting paid more, doing less work thing, it's not working out, Steve.
In the second, thank you for joining me. I'm your host, Dan Platt. Do the intro over again. This is Radical Left Wing Talk Radio, talk show. I'm gonna talk about some heady things here, but hopefully be very informative and get you thinking about things a little differently. Next week, I'll try to focus on more concrete things. But of course, everything is concrete. We're talking about real things here. Especially when it comes to just a different way of thinking. Because our thoughts do affect our actions, everything else. So, I know I should start with something lighter, but I got what I got in front of me here. So, last hour I talked about, middle section was about escaping capitalism. How even the richest of the rich, your Trumps, your Kanyes, are in fact trying to escape capitalism in some way. Maybe they already have. Total freedom is in fact theirs, both negative and positive. Negative freedom from others, from other attention, and positive, they can do what they want within a certain reason or a reason in some of their cases. So you don't like capitalism. So back up. I'm going to read this long thing. I'm not going to read all of it. It's more just some concepts, and I'll read more of the economic history that it goes through. So this is a philosopher, Swiss, Hansi Friedrich, and he is kind of promotes meta-modernism. So you have modernism, that there are narratives to life, you know, progress and rationality, and then post-modernism, a response to that, a skepticism of that, and he's trying to synthesize, kind of have both, best of both, the good and drop the bad, because there are many bad cons to either, and try to forge a better way of thinking about things. His book is called The Listening Society, and so he doesn't identify as a socialist or whatever, not a lefty, I guess, but he's definitely out there in terms of ideas. So if you want, you know, this would be a great father for Joe Rogan, I guess. But he does look at things materially, like that. And he's a good explainer. And I'm going to spend this hour mostly talking, using his words and his concepts. They might not gel completely with what I was talking about in the first hour, but I think there'll be lots of dovetailing. And you yourself can say, like, oh, I could see these puzzle pieces fitting together. So first, defining capitalism. He does it differently than the other articles did. But what is it? Off the hip, what's your razor-sharp definition? So it goes through, it creates a positive feedback loop. Oh, sorry. So first, define capital itself. So mind if I have a go at it? All right, here's my take. It's something that creates a positive feedback loop. The feedback loop changes social relations, which allow power to be accumulated for a person or organization to which the feedback loop is linked. So that's capital. And capitalism is then, that is a system. You see an action with a small business owner, you see an action with a megacorp, and you see an action with Trump. So anything that makes you more powerful vis-a-vis others and that can grow and expand itself by proper management is capital. A positive feedback loop means that you tend to get more of it once you have a certain amount. It creates an advantage from which you can get more of the same or more of something similar. It's possible to add another dimension. Capital must have some kind of psychological lure or desirability. There must be something we can fetishize, something we can crave, possess, and call our own, or be possessed by. Otherwise, it won't do, and thus it can't be capital. So it doesn't mean money is the only form of capital. There's also sexual desirability, sexual attractiveness, rather, which being fit and beautiful can potentially give you a movie career. And the social capital gained from that can sometimes be exchanged for political capital, and not least a lot of money capital as well. If you can also get laid, in fact, pretty much all kinds of capital can get you laid. And erotic capital itself can likewise be exchanged for almost all other kinds. Even if it means social capital of a loving family and good friends. Number of friends and contacts and the quality of those relationships can give you many advantages. In fact, it's almost impossible to accumulate other forms of capital without it. We pretend, I'm adding this, we pretend we're in a meritocracy, and in certain instances, I suppose, they're like, say, our civil society, it is. No, actually, I walked that back. Even in civil society, there is predication on who you know. And to the struggling person, it is unfair. But as far as us being social animals, it is entirely fair and proper. What we need to do is stop pretending that we want or need a meritocracy, and that's fair, and instead accept that we're social species and social capital matters, and start designing our society around how social capital matters and that people aren't left out if they can't get it. If you're disabled, if you're ugly, quote unquote, you need to take account of that. And a basic income does, you know, where everyone gets the production of our economy. And again, let's go back to the article then. And this is a long essay, actually. Article is not accurate. It also makes it more likely for you to get a good job. In fact, if you're not capable of establishing that initial social capital at a job interview, you probably won't get it. So just like having lots of money helps you get even more money, positive feedback loop, so does having a lot of friends help you get even more. And these things can be exchanged for each other. Can't buy friend, you say? Well, why do rich people usually have lots of people they call their friends? Like Trump and Kanye are friends. While bums in the street usually are all alone. Capital attracts other capital, and if you have a lot of one kind, it's easier to get the other kind you need. So what other kinds are there? Well, historically, I'm talking all human history here, there has been one most important form of capital. And he has a picture of from 300. So it's organized violence, to be specific. Prior to the modern era, the ones who controlled an army were usually also the ones who controlled the economy. By having a big army, rulers and warlords could simply accumulate all the forms of capital they wanted by sheer force, by sheer use of force, and often by the mere threat of it. Controlling a piece of land with an army could grant one additional land by conquest, or just further increase the size of one's army by gaining even more soldiers and silver and so on, until you meet someone else's army. This is the positive feedback loop. Organized violence could be exchanged for other forms of capital. And who doesn't want to be friends with the warrior chief himself? History is not shy of telling us that organized violence has been the most fundamental form of capital throughout history. And with a modern phrasing, one with a very favorable exchange rate. So that's what the past has looked like, before money capital ruled the world, as it does today. But in the future, and this is where we go into the speculative, another form of capital will be king, the social capital. He has a picture of some hipsters painting some art on a wall. I have some friends who look just like this. These people might look cute and harmless, but they are increasingly a force to be reckoned with. This is because they have large amounts of cultural capital. In the future, this form of capital, not money, will be at the center of the economy. The ones who have large amounts of cultural capital are able to exchange it at ever more favorable exchange rates. That means getting other forms of capital in large quantities for a smaller quantity of that precious, of their precious cultural capital. But not only are such people getting well paid for their services in virtue of their larger amounts of cultural value, they are better at getting and keeping the precious attention of others. Keep that in mind. More likely to be listened to. Their ability to gain the attention of others will make them increasingly more powerful in the future, to an extent that they will finally dominate the economy. So then it goes back, like I usually do, to clarify what an economy is. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but in short, the economy is not just the flow of money and goods, but it's the management of it. Okay? So maybe I will read some of it. When you think of housework put forth by many feminist scholars, this activity usually doesn't involve the exchange of money and is mostly not considered economically relevant. But the domestic duties performed by women throughout history and today have been absolutely crucial for the functioning of society. Taking care of children is usually not considered work. But if someone does it for money, it suddenly becomes real work. However, if it's still the same activity, still the same economic task is being performed. Same with sex. Not considered work, right? Unless you're a sex worker. So the economy isn't just boiled down to money or work. It is boiled down to the management. When one economizes, one is caring about time and attention of limited resources. I'm sorry, of resources. And our most limited resource is time and the attention of others. You get attention in a validation game. That's why I mentioned it before. That's how these other things dovetail, you'll see. Our time and attention is more fundamental than work and money, or money and work. It's what is at the very core of the economy. For example, I'm reading this text and you're listening to the radio, and giving me your attention is economic action. You could have done something else, but you chose to, you economized those scarce resources. Maybe you're just bored. In that regard, all our actions are economic priorities, all of them. Taking a hike in the forest, talking to your neighbor, and doing activism, you could have done something else. Hence, economy is all about our behavior and relations. It's about our behavior as we spend time doing and towards which relations we direct our attention. So it isn't some stockbroker sitting in downtown New York. The essence of the economy is not the wizardry of the stock exchange brokers, the bankers, and the other occupations we're accustomed to. The economy runs much deeper than numbers presented on balance sheets. So with that, we'll go to our first break. Thank you for joining me for this time, and thank you for choosing to economize your time and giving me your attention. Oh, your sweet, sweet attention. Toodles. Welcome back to the Three Left Show, where if you don't like reading like Kanye, listening to others read things is the next best thing. A crash course. And by the way, nuance. I do respect Kanye as a music producer. I do enjoy what he produces at some level, musically. Lyrically, maybe not. But definitely not, actually. A lot of crap there. But musically, I get it. So crash course in economic history, okay? Sorry again if this bores you. Maybe it won't. So first, let's go all the way back to what is called the Agrarian Revolution. Step one. Okay, so here we go. So a short introduction. I welcome you to Crash Course in Economic History. If you already feel familiar with the history of the world, you can skip past it. Well, that would be me, but I have read so much. I'm quite a history buff. I even minored in it. But let's begin with the agrarian regime. It calls it, you know, a model of human society, which was can be divided into two overarching steps of development. First is the management of surplus from the natural world via farming. A novel invention of the agricultural revolution was the way in which humans began to deliberately extract, manage, and alter naturally occurring resources. And he puts in all these economic terms. And this is all ganging up for his argument that he's making about social capital being like the future important capital of our time. But the new, so we have, you know, the surplus of management, but a new problem arose. In denser societies in closer proximity, often competing societies, meant that conflicts became inevitable. Anthropological as well as archaeological investigations show that war seems to be endemic among horticultural early agrarian societies. Security, rather than mere survival, thus became a critical concern. This circumstance paved the way for the next step in development, the development of states. The exploitation of a new energy source, that of human bodies, form of labor, and the time of warriors. The way in which human bodies can be seen as an exploitable energy source is obviously not that this measure of production has been made available, not been made available prior to the turn of history, but because of the new circumstances that arose in a more sedentary farming community. Suddenly, with steep social hierarchies, other humans suddenly became exploitable for other purposes than their own. However, this was true only for particular agents. So I just want to point out that this is his interpretation of history. There are many other interpretations. To wrap them all together, they're all pieces of the puzzle, and you can kind of combine them and there's points to be made. So here I'm just going about his points here. So slaves and other dependents were treated as human stores of energy, like living batteries, so to speak. And because humans are more efficient converters of food to energy than many animals, they were more valuable. So it's basically explaining why slavery economically even exists in the first place. Aided by organized violence, and since agriculture generated a considerable amount of surplus labor, not preoccupied with food production, rulers could use their authority to allocate the energy of other humans, other people, to tasks that had been difficult before, if not outright impossible, for a foraging society, such as erecting large monuments, crafting goods, and having trained warriors. But then everything changed again. So he speaks of the capitalist revolution. Whereas organized violence was the primary capital to organize society, those who held the soldiers held everything. Modernity has money capital as its primary means to manage our actions. With the what we usually call the capitalist revolution, controlling a big army was no longer the most crucial measure of power. When the descendants of the medieval merchants started to control huge amounts of money, they could muster larger armies and weapons than the old landed elite, not least by entering alliances with kings. The logic of organized violence became subordinated to the logic of money capital, these merchants. The masters of the world were no longer the aristocratic knights in shiny armor, but the accountants and the savvy merchants in their humble suits. By managing the surplus energy of human labor and carefully investing and reinvesting the labor for other uses, they could accumulate larger amounts of resources and power than any warrior by means of plunder alone. And when this was coupled with newly discovered methods to exploit the energy of millions of years of stored solar power, form of fossil fuels, boom, a new age dawned, and we saw the beginnings of a society we have today. With modernity, the hard logic of one regime was finally supplemented by another. And he says supplemented, not replaced. Why? Because he points out that organized violence was not replaced by organized money. Organized violence aids organized money. So we have two models, two regimes. The agrarian that manages the natural world and has a new energy resource. All the people that aren't just foraging for food anymore. And then the industrial regime, which manages the human world and surplus energy of the time, which was money, or rather management of investments, and then has a new energy source to exploit, fossil fuels. We see that the structure and sequential logic of these two developmental models resemble each other and are rather symmetrical. History repeats, I say it rhymes, but that's here and over there. First, humans learn to manage surplus energy of an existing resource. Then they discover how to exploit a new one. Yet there is also a qualitative progression. In the agrarian regime, the main concern is security, and the primary capital to achieve it is organized violence. The more soldiers you have, the safer you can feel. But when the early modern state finally acquires a firm monopoly on violence, right? So let's say the king or the emperor finally drives underfoot all the bandit gangs and pirates, and finally is the and there's no competing lord and consolidates the control of all of the soldiers and the armies. So that's finally the state. And this is the modern state. This is one of the things about the modern state. This came about in the Renaissance era, where the state finally can hire all the mercenaries and raise armies full time, right? Monopoly on violence. The main concern moves towards property, and the primary capital to acquire that becomes money. However, that's not all. Capitalism relies on delicate measures of handling information. And thus the invention of the printing press becomes very, very important to that. The printing press also gave rise to the scientific revolution and thus time, thus even further economic growth. And that's all another story, but it's all part of the human story, our story. So, the industrial economy also created an entirely new class structure. I don't need to go into that. Already mentioned that in the previous article earlier in the hour about classes, workers, owners, rulers. So class structure of rulers, free men, and slaves in the agricultural and in the industrial model, we have capitalists, the bourgeois, smaller owners, and proletariat, working class people. But there are also transitional eras between the two, right? Can't just say there's this the line that you draw in one's, you know, pre-Renaissance and post-Renaissance or Middle Age. And he calls it the Axial Age, which is roughly around like 500 BCE. Before the emergence of capitalism and the agrarian regime was profoundly changed by intellectual developments. So before the economy and the management of it actually changed, you had change of thinking first. Philosophy of the Greeks. You have Confucius in China, and Buddhism, and in India, and Judaism in the Levant, or the Judaic tradition, and they changed thought about the world and how we should organize society, and it all became possible with the invention of a new technology of that time, namely literature, like actual written language. Combined with the state's ever firm monopoly on violence, growing wealth, and increased literacy in a wider population proportion of the populace, new dangerous ideas started to emerge in both political and intellectual challengers from the periphery. Rebels like Jesus of Nazareth and Siddhartha, the Buddha, emerged. The old myths and the political legitimacy of the established political order was scrutinized, and from a more critical point of view, while novel ways which sought to address the dire needs of the all-forgotten souls of the empire and the hardships of the farmers. The old myths didn't satisfy the emotional and spiritual needs of people anymore. The divine Sun King didn't appear as morally legitimate any longer, and new radical solutions were needed to meet the growing social unrest and discontent with the political elite, those that helped, you know, monopoly on violence. But for all the progress we had made, life shouldn't be this hard and unjust. But what could be the remedy? That was the cry of these people. Sounds familiar? Well, it should. And so a new development of class structure was created. Clergy as a political force to be reckoned with. The emperor had to sublimate themselves. And so his general argument, historical case here, that he's making is before the whole economy, the regime of the economy could change from organized violence to money, there had to be this transitionary period where you had the desire and the institutions to call for the more just use of organized violence. So kings could no longer do as they will, but now had to at least pretend that they were good, pious Christians. And many were. Many were. Moral teachings and pro-social behavior were developed, and preachers encouraged people to let go of their immediate self-interest in furtherance of a greater good, often with the promise of eternal bliss and afterlife. However, if we know, as we know, the critics of what we call the Faustian agrarian regime, so feudalism, the Middle Ages, think of that, only partly succeeded in creating a fair society. They rarely, or ever, or never, achieved the divine state they would preach about, but many brutal customs were abandoned, and behaviors that previously had been commonly accepted as part of everyday life were now frowned upon. Pious attitudes and behaviors were rewarded, and rulers could not behave as arbitrarily as before. Society became a little bit more humane, and many people acquired higher things to believe in, higher principles to strive for. So now he goes into how our postmodern age, that we've been doing the same thing. You know, capital money has been the driving driver of the economy since the Renaissance. It's been about 500 years now. And especially since, you know, with information technology as it is now, we have our new information technology, the internet, and, you know, telecoms, that we're kind of in the same thing, that we're developing the ideas, socialism, anarchism, for example, of a more fair, just world. We do not have the means of doing so, and even when one tries, one is still using money as the primary means of managing the economy. Thus, you have state capitalism, the communist regimes that we have and have had. So he talks about postmodernity, and I don't really want to bore you with that, but postmodernity has its own righteous rebels affiliated with churches such as queer feminism, post-colonialism, and environmental protection. These rebels can also set to constitute a new priesthood, those that are thought leaders. Despite being a minority, promos, postmodernists, in virtue of often higher levels of education, but also since their arguments conceptually beat modern arguments at their own game, have managed to change public discourse in favor of postmodern values to a considerable degree, something that reactionaries now are fighting against. About how postmodernity has made life a little more humane. You know, gay rights, more and more people can be part of the in-group. Tolerance for ethnic and sexual minorities has improved. That is a long way to go. But gender relations are not as rigid and oppressive as before, and measures have been taken to save the environment in some ways. But where modernity, inhibited by the logic of its national ethnocentrism, meaning USA, USA, failed in creating a larger circle of solidarity encompassing all people in all nations, postmodernity is currently succeeding in producing world citizens with multicultural values and a global perspective. So just like that transition in the Middle Ages managed to create great civilizational world religions, incorporating people of many different creeds and cultures within it. You know, an Indonesian can be a Muslim as easily as an Egyptian, as easily as a Spaniard. And someone in Brazil can be a Catholic, and someone as easily as someone in Ireland. I'm adding that in. Here is a presentation of these transitional eras, and he has a little chart here. So, you know, so just as we have mass media today, and also new classes, where instead of the clergy, we have the creative class. Okay, so just catching up to the present day, that just as in the Middle Ages, you had the new class of clergy that could hold the holders of organized violence, the armies, the lands, accountable to better morals, we have a creative class that is developing the ability to influence our rulers to act more morally. Like the social justice warriors and how, and we see that playing out, that struggle playing out with the Kavanaugh hearings and everything on our social media threads. So that's one way of understanding it. And I think it makes a bit of sense. Okay, welcome back to the last section of the Three Left Show, a show that discusses socialism, anarchism, and ecology. Those are the three lefts I refer to. And today I've been talking, reviewing a economic history or a essay from the meta-modernist philosopher in this hour. And I'm going to continue with an excerpt from his book, The Listening Society, A Meta-Modern Guide to Politics. Book one. Ooh, how fancy. It's like he's the next Marx or something. So this is from an excerpt called The Reign of Hackers, Hipsters, and Hippies. So when I last left off, I was mentioning the rise of the creative class in the context of transitioning away from capitalism and escaping it and having something else. Something more socialist, something more anarchist, something more ecological, right? That's how it ties into my show. Being a part of the attention economy, I want your attention. I'm building social capital. Being part of this community radio station, I meet people, I make friends and contacts for economic opportunities and so on. So it all kind of ties together. I'm sure everyone does that in their lives to some degree. Maybe you feel threatened by this extremely relatable content. I know I will. Reading this. So these people, hackers, hipsters, and hippies, they're not just annoying, but they are about to take over the world. They are the ones with the highest amount of cultural capital. Oh, you know, before I go on, so my friend Lauren is reacting, and I'm going to read out. So social capital. Who should be able to unionize? Sex workers should be able to unionize and get health insurance. Totally agree. And then because she's researching this, the inmates of the Utica State Lunatic Asylum were forced into labor using the printing press and other types of labor in the 1840s and forward. Today, I think they call it BOCES. Slam. Okay. BOCES is like the county educational program where people work and they don't get paid. Let's see now. Okay, continuing on. And he makes a case that we can outcompete capitalism, that the people with the highest cultural capital, the next kind, because they trade it at a very favorable exchange rate. The reason for that is that their services, products, and ideas have a competitive advantage. They are simply capable of creating the stuff everyone wants. These people are the main agents with crucial sectors. And by the way, the rest of the essay that I neglected to read, though, because of time constraints, is that the new energy we need to rather than fossil fuels is emotional energy. The kind of stuff you get from being validated by people around you, whether from thought leaders or the group you're in, maybe from your family, whatever. But family relations can be much healthier. Validation gangs are usually unhealthy. It's a bunch of individuals jabbing at each other online, very toxic all the time. So here's we get to know these agents of change. So this is just about covering what he calls the three ages. So hackers are not just people who illegally gain access to computer systems. And the hackers he refers to self-identified, like those of Facebook's founder Mark Zuckerberg, and or not, like many of those who nonetheless participate in programming events known as hackathons, produce digital solutions and software that reduce the complexity of society and make it manageable. Of course, not all IT workers, computer engineers, and programmers are considered hackers in this sense. Only the ones who combine those skills with an intimate, embodied knowledge of digital culture. So digital problem solving plus digital culture. The meme makers. They combine software development with cultural capital and social capital, i.e. with a sensitive knowledge of culture and people, with a rich understanding of its symbols. You'll find many of these people in creative industries ranging from smaller app startups to some of the more visionary departments at Google and other major actors, the independent indie game development scene, and other social innovation projects. They invent solutions that bypass many of the old capitalist ways of distributing services and info. Digitizing and gamifying education, for example, making it more module-based. They're democratizing medical equipment by creating mobile applications that measure everything from brainwaves to heart rates to environmental impact our purchasing. They work to create mobile solutions to help payments and pricing in developing economies and help sharing videos of abuses or facilitating other forms of whistleblowing. Data mining and AI play increasingly important parts in all this. The increasing saturation of computer games, I know it does for me, and everyday life offer many platforms to such endeavors. So this group is growing in importance because it offers us the software solutions that can only come from great creativity and the cultural capital and digital know-how. I certainly don't have it. But then there are hipsters. Now, hipsters aren't just people with particular style fashion, or the pretentious college kids who show off their supposedly good taste in music. The hipster I refer to, the writer, to produce the many symbols, producers of symbols, that help us orientate ourselves, to make sense and find meaning in our digital age. Here you find a wide array of artists, designers, thinkers, social entrepreneurs, writers, and bloggers. I think man here is part of that. They developed the ideas of posthumanism and transhumanism. That means going beyond what's human and cyborg stuff and whatnot. Complexity and network researchers and other participatory forms of politics and social movements. Point at myself. Critique of wage labor. Oh, I know I do that. Oh, yeah, and the often irrational nature of work in the economy. Ecological and social resilience is something else, and it is a long list. I could say and so on and so on. Personal development, organizational, the new gender and sexual relations, what Jordan Peterson doesn't want to do. Who decides what's harassment and what doesn't? Well, thought leaders, people of cultural capital do. And if you don't like that, you want shared cultural capital? You want to, share the wealth, as it were? And by their own taste in fashion, art, and lifestyle, they embody these new thoughts. Whereas the hackers rely on a combination of digital skill and culture, the hipsters rely on a greater amount of cultural capital only, combined with their own personal networks, i.e. social capital. People who adopt and successfully wield and display these symbols gain different kinds of advantages. Companies turn greater revenue. An individual person appears more sensitive and sophisticated. Cities and municipalities can brand themselves as attractive, dynamic hubs. The hipsters are becoming more powerful because it is becoming increasingly difficult for most of us to grasp and navigate our society presently. And they offer us tools for doing so. Last are the hippies. Here's where I get really, jabbing the side here. The hippies, then. I see myself, based on these descriptions, in between a hipster and hippie. The hippies, then, I can see that this is a silly use of the term because hippie was originally derived from the word hipster. Oh, and fun trivial fact, the word hip, its etymology, is from West Africa, and it means to see. So hipness, coolness, is a matter of perception and seeing the truth, seeing beyond, you know. And jive is a bunk. So, like, to say one's hip to their jive is to say I see through their crap. Fun little language fact. I got that from, like, a book about how most American culture is, in fact, black culture. So thank you. Thank you, blackness. The hippies are not quite the same as the hippies of the old, the starry-eyed New Agers who looked at astrology, crystals, and transpersonal psychologies and gurus, but rather the people with highly developed skills in meditation, contemplation, body practice, psychedelics, drugs, diets, and physical training, and profound forms of intimate communication and sexuality are, you know, many social workers, and simple life wisdoms that apply to our day and age. You'll find more rational and research-based approaches to psychedelics, communities for self-development, and eco-village living, a more science-driven meditation, and stress-release practices. Coaches of all kinds fit into this. The elaborate forms of practices for achieving higher mental states and spiritual experiences, so on. So the hippies are becoming a force to be reckoned with because they provide social and personal technologies. The technology, by the way, is not just like your phone, but it's like a meditation is like a personal technology. And by the way, this is what theory is all about. Taking a bunch of things that are, listing all of these groups of people, and putting them in a category as change agents, you know, and trying to wrap our head around it, of what's happening. So the force to be reckoned with because they provide social and personal technologies for maintaining health, happiness, and community, and a sense of enchantment to an increasingly strange and alienating world. Sometimes this takes the form of vegan diets, sustainable lifestyles, also called lifestyleism, which there's a critique to have of that, by the way, organic farming for self-sufficiency, and relative withdrawals from modern life. Relative, like retreats and stuff. If you can afford it, nice for them. But the activism always reasserts itself in the mainstream. It always comes back to a will to engage with others, not least via social media. The sort of hippies we're talking about here are generally highly educated and rely upon knowledge of medicine and physiology, psychology. This, too, can be seen as a form of cultural capital. Hippies without such cultural sensitivity fall behind and remain the older kind of hippies. What I usually call the crunchy, in non-derogatory way. So what unifies these three groups? One thing is that all three groups share an alternative relationship to work and the market. They're all driven by what psychologists of work call intrinsic motivation, rather than the extrinsic, such as monetary rewards. You know, instead of getting paid, it's about doing the good job and feeling good about yourself. This means that they work by another social and economic logic. So this comes back to that previous lecture I just gave. A different logic is needed to overcome capitalism. And these three groups, mostly because they're being paid well enough, but, not always. Of course, this is an outflow of post-materialist and highly individualized societies, in which significant parts of the population have a luxury to think much less about how to pay the bills and more about how they can change the world. Bangladesh is not full of these people, but California is. Because of the idiosyncratic, meaning it's very wish up and down, nature of these endeavors, the Triple H folks find it hard to fit in with the classical, hierarchical, and meritocratic organizations. Many of them will have rebelled against such structures and try to find ways to work outside and beyond them. Outside academia, by lecturing on YouTube. outside major corporations and even medium-sized companies and beside public bureaucracies. No doubt, organizations that find ways to attract and keep these agents and harness their talents will gain great competitive advantage in the future. The second and most significant thing that unites them is the fact that they all rely more on cultural capital and less upon the economic, the money. As such, they form a complex but united front against capitalist society. Okay, you know, I have to move ahead. Just to wrap up, I'm very threatened by this content because I see a lot of myself in that. But there are some cons to the Triple H population. We have uncertainty of levels of expectations. I'm always unsure of what's expected of me in a job interview. There's a lot of crap, a lot of bunk, and there's a lot of empty networking. Uncertainty of expectations has to do with the extreme differences in responses that can be reduced by their work. There's a lot of haters, there's a lot of lovers. If you work hard and put your stuff out there, almost anything can happen. You can become a star, get a solid international upper middle class career, or you can be completely ignored. There can be fame and glory for a major breakthrough or a lifetime of frustrations and precariousness. So a lot of Triple H are also in the precarious workers, like myself. This is a revolving door between a creative class and a precariat. There are a great distance between these expectations, strivings, and hopes of these non-conventional lifestyles. At least since the classical sociologist worked out at last century, it has been known that expectations minus realities is how you calculate a major factor in ill mental health and human misery. Bunk means that there needs to be a lot of big talk when you deal with bigger and more abstract issues. New organizational paradigm, a revolution in how we apply data mining to our problems, a major innovation in our technical detail, a profound global movement or a club for self-admiration, a validation gang. Perhaps there is so much understanding and context needed. There's a lot of empty networking. It's a wasteful activity that a lot of us, myself, know all too well. How many coffees and lunches and Skype conferences have been held and evenings attended that led anywhere and nowhere? So what's important, we're a creative class, we're creating, you know, we have the cultural capital. So his usual case in most of his work in the Listening Society is that the creative class is like going to be the basis of the new leaders of and how we get past capitalism. Even if it's through organizing all these anarchist and socialist things, even. So it all ties together. And I'm going to bring it back around. And who is a thought leader that we give our attention to, who validates us emotionally in some ways, giving us he does things we love and he does things we hate. Kanye frickin' West brought it back around. Him and Trump, both, they don't have to worry about the money. They're rich. They're upper class. And they can do whatever they want. They're free. They've escaped the rat race. And now they're the thought leaders. Now, of course, Kanye, the ultimate hipster. And Trump is none of these three things. He's old hat. And he represents reaction to all these things. Because he is, in fact, the opposite of the hippies, the hipsters, and the hackers. You know, we're all part of that resistance in some one way or another, and we're resisting it all. So let's end with some housekeeping, as I always do, to reiterate that the show is podcast, can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, and other podcast apps you use. Just do a search for the Three Lefts Show. That's numeral three Lefts Show. Archived is all previous episodes and recordings at threelefts.news. That is all it is, threelefts.news. And I also have a Facebook page. Please contact and communicate via that. I also Twitter. I use that less, but I will get the notification should you at me. And please at me. Please. And what else? And a Patreon page to support me individually. But of course, this is a community radio station. The show and its quality depends on this grassroots outside of the normal economy, though it is a nonprofit, and we are about to get a big state grant to upgrade everything. So, yay for public investment. Okay, so thank you for joining me. It is noon. Happy lunchtime. I'm going to go get it because I'm starving. Thank you for joining me and bearing with me. My voice held. Pat on the back. Thank you very much for joining me. Solidarity to you all, and to all a good week until next week. Thank you very much. Be well.